loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, the National Security Agency, NSA, has reportedly shut down a system that analyzes logs of Americans' domestic calls and text messages, but it retains vast domestic and international spying capabilities. Next, Chinese electronics giant Huawei is preparing to sue the U.S. government for barring federal agencies from using the company's products. Then, Venezuelan opposition leader Juan Guaido returned to the country yesterday without incident after meeting with the right-wing leaders of Colombia and Brazil in defiance of a Supreme Court order prohibiting him from leaving the country. And then the Trump administration has canceled agreements that give Turkey and India preferential treatment in trade. And finally, following statements from top European leaders, expectations are mounting that the long-anticipated departure of the UK from the European Union will be delayed. But before we get to those stories, we'll go over today's headlines. 84 protesters were arrested in a police crackdown on a demonstration in Sacramento, California last night. Demonstrators were voicing their outrage at the district attorney's announcement that there would be no charges in the police killing of Stephon Clark last year. Whistleblower Chelsea Manning's challenge against a subpoena to testify before a grand jury in Virginia was rejected by a judge today. It's widely believed that the grand jury in question is targeting WikiLeaks and Julian Assange. Manning has vowed to continue to fight in court against the subpoena. Lockheed Martin secured nearly $1 billion from Saudi Arabia today as part of a deal to sell the kingdom the highly advanced THAAD missile system. Arms sales to Saudi Arabia have come under increasing scrutiny in response to the brutal war on Yemen and the killing of journalist Jamal Khashoggi. Lockheed Martin stands to make up to $15 billion in total from the missile sales. Three explosive devices were mailed to transportation hubs in London today. Police say the packages contained small incendiary bombs. Two airports and a train station were targeted. Those are today's headlines. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
Now we turn to NSA and privacy issues. The National Security Agency has reportedly shut down a system that analyzes logs of Americans' domestic calls and text messages, halting a program that has been the source of controversy over privacy since the 9/11 attacks. The program apparently ended months ago, and the Trump administration appears that it will not ask Congress to reauthorize it. But the NSA retains vast domestic and international spying capabilities. We're joined from Washington by Bill Binney. He's a former NSA technical director who became a legendary national security whistleblower. Welcome back, Bill.
Well, thanks for having me back. Yeah.
Bill, the irony that this is exactly what Ed Snowden was warning Americans about can't be lost on people in the executive branch and certainly in the Eastern District of Virginia, where Snowden has been charged with several, maybe many, myriad national security crimes. He warned us that this program was taking place, that it was illegal, it was unconstitutional, and now our policymakers have decided it's better that we don't have this program. What do you make of this?
Well, you see, that's the same program that I was complaining about internally in the channels,
that's
like
right.
In the House and Senate Intelligence Committees.
You put your career on the line for your opposition to this program.
But that was just the start of it. See, that was only the metadata part of it. The ultimate part started earlier and a little shortly after that in 2002, and it's called the Upstream Program. They call it the Upstream Program. So you remember from the PRISM program slide where the government goes to the telecommunications companies and service providers and says, give us data on this person because we got a warrant or something. That's their upfront fake approach that says, here's where we're conforming with the law. See, don't worry about us. We're doing the right thing. In the background is this upstream program, which is the fiber optic taps, where they're taking everything off the fiber lines, you know, using AT&T and Verizon and about 30 other companies inside the country, not counting the ones around the world, and all the other redundancies that are existing with other parties like the second parties, where if they collect stuff, it gets forwarded into. Those are the programs where the real data is collected. And all this idea, and in fact, some of the, I think the Wall Street Journal alleged that they were only considering it. They hadn't actually done it. So But what it's saying is, fundamentally, that the upstream program has been running for so long and developed to such an extent that the telecommunications company giving any batch load of here's all the communications we had with our from our service for everybody, that no longer adds anything. So in other words, the upstream bulk acquisition of data on everybody is complete. So that tells me the whole thing is a farce.
And that actually was my next question. Does shutting this down affect the national security in any way?
Absolutely not. It never helped in the first place. I mean, they were collecting. What it did was it hindered analysts from seeing what was really important for them to look at, because that gave them so much data. I mean, they can go into these, look at all the communities and of contacts and phones and emails and so on, and just go keep going and endless degrees of separation and looking at people all over the place, and never actually find anything meaningful. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. That's because all the material that was dumped on them was just burying them with irrelevancies. You know, they just had no. The thing we were doing with Thin Thread, which I liken it to saying, we were pulling all the needles and potential needles out of the haystack and letting the haystack go right by. So your analyst had nothing but relevant and important information to look at. That's not what they're doing today, and hasn't been since 2001.
And we're talking about billions of little bits of information, maybe trillions of pieces of information, are we not?
Yeah, well, my estimate was just in the phone network alone that in the U.S. it was roughly 3 billion transactions every day.
A day?
So, every day. And that meant that, I mean, that's the record for local and long-distance phone calls.
Wow.
I mean, just inside the U.S., now, my estimate around the world is something on the order of 12 billion, as many as 12 billion a day.
12 billion a day. Where is all this stuff stored? And how can an analyst get through this kind of information? Did this not set people back? Did this not set back investigations because there was too much information?
Oh, absolutely. Hmm. That was the whole point. I mean, that's why we did the Thin Thread program in the 1990s. Even back then, when they had nowhere near the capacity to collect data that they do today, even back then they were buried. The analysts were complaining in NSA. I mean, I was a technical director for the analysis and reporting area for the world, and that was about 6,000 analysts, and they all had the same problem. They were just being buried with information even back then. So that's why we did the Thin Thread program, to devise a way to make it possible to get only relevant information that was meaningful to the targets they were looking at. And so that was the whole point of it, to reduce that burden on them so they only got a finite number of things that were relevant every day and didn't have to look through this mass amount of data. I mean, they get tens of thousands of items every day, and they'd have to go through them. And you can only go so far in a day, and if you have to stop and record anything, you stop there, and then you never get through the rest of it. Next day you come in, there's a new batch of data from that day, So, and it was just an endless process of making them dysfunctional.
Just so I have this straight, Bill, it's not that the capabilities are going away. It's just that they decided to stop this mass collection of data. Is that correct? If the FBI, let's say, wants to do an investigation, can they not still rely on the technology to collect the data that they need?
Actually, they've already got it collected with the upstream program.
Uh-huh.
That was my point. See, the all these other programs, like the Verizon warrant that the FISA court issued, the general warrant that they issued to say, here, give up all the data on your 110+ million people who are your subscribers. That all is now being collected in upstream, and that program adds nothing anymore. So there's no reason to spend money on it. Why don't you just get rid of it? That's really the point of it. That doesn't count, by the way, John, the ability of them to go to places like GCHQ or other countries.
Oh, okay.
And them for any data that they have on internally. I mean, after all, they have the same. The chances that data you have can be passed through other countries
right.
And back into the U.S., so there's a probability of that, too. So.
And the U.S. famously cooperates with most intelligence services around the world for this kind of data, so they're not actually losing data. All they have to do is ask a liaison partner for access to data, correct?
Actually, they don't even have to do that because the collection would be done by the partners, but all that data, near as I can tell, is being forwarded to NSA for storage.
Oh, boy.
They're the central repository for all this data for everybody.
Oh, I did not know that. Is that why they built that giant facility out in Utah?
That's one of them, and they've got another one going three times the size over here in Fort Meade.
In Maryland, yeah.
And the point is that then they give, and if you could see it, like a couple of countries that have, IC Reach, or which is the close-in people, the departments of agencies within the U.S. and the Five Eyes. The others, the third parties, basically, are using X Key Score to interrogate the data that they forward to be stored by NSA. They're all using these programs to interrogate the NSA database. They became basically the central repository for all the data collected from the Five Eyes and at least nine other countries, including, Poland and Germany and Japan and of course, all the Five Eyes. So UK, Canada, Australia, New Zealand.
I don't think most Americans had any idea. I mean, I consider myself an intelligence professional and I had no idea, but we're out of time, unfortunately. We were happy to be joined from Washington by Bill Binney. Bill is a former NSA technical director who became a legendary national security whistleblower. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Walter Smolarek, joined in studio by Brian Becker. Chinese electronics giant Huawei is preparing to sue the U.S. government for barring federal agencies from using the company's products. Huawei executives believe the move could force the U.S. to make public whatever evidence, if there is any evidence, it has against the company. Meanwhile, Huawei CFO Meng Wanzhou has filed a suit in Canada for violating her constitutional rights as she continues her fight against extradition to the United States. We're joined from London by Jude Woodward. She is the author of the new book, The U.S. versus China, Asia's New Cold War. Welcome back, Jude.
Nice to be here.
So tell us about this lawsuit, first of all, Huawei suing the U.S. government for the order that would prohibit federal agencies from using the company's products, perhaps not actually intended to win that lawsuit, but to make a point, rather. What's their strategy?
Well, I think that's probably right. But I think the lawsuit makes a very valid point, which is that these, as I understand Huawei's case, is that these executive orders on security were imposed without Huawei being given any evidence on which this was based. So it's essentially trial without evidence. And so I think one of the things, as you said in your intro, that they're particularly concerned to get out of this is to either expose the fact there is no evidence, which I would imagine is what they hope will be the case, or if there is evidence, to find out what it is exactly.
Right. I mean, the basic allegation that the U.S. government makes against Huawei, you know, one of the biggest technology firms in the world based in China, one of the most important companies in China, is that it's essentially, you know, a Trojan horse for the Chinese government to carry out all sorts of surveillance activities in the United States. Do you think there's much merit to those claims?
Huawei has rather unusually for a Chinese company, for that particular company, which is rather quiet and not secretive is the wrong word, that seems to play into the US agenda about it, but it doesn't do a lot of publicity work. It just puts its products out there. It has made very clear public statements, unusually saying it does not give information to the Chinese government, and it categorically denies that this is the case. So that rather lends credence, I would say, to the argument that it's not true, because I don't think they would make such clear and unambiguous statements if they thought that evidence was about to be turned up that they did.
Right. And of course, other countries might have, you know, also very valid concerns about cooperation between U.S. tech giants and the government. I mean, it is kind of the nature of being a giant corporation. You have to have some sort of relationship with the government just to operate. Let's talk for a moment about what this judicial process might uncover. So I mean, is your sense that, you know, the U.S. government really doesn't have anything here? And if this campaign against Huawei is not based on hard evidence, if they don't, you know, sincerely believe the charges that they're making, what is the true motivation? Why is Huawei such a big target in the crosshairs of the United States government?
if it's not true, and let's for the moment assume it's not true, then I think it's clear that the reason that has been widely speculated in the media, which is that the US administration does not want a Chinese company to become the leading company on 5G technology and then possibly move ahead on other new technologies, so that rather than the whole world being dependent on the most advanced US technologies, in some areas at least, the world would become dependent on Chinese technologies. And that's actually totally normal part of the development of markets, etc. But the US makes a difference with China because it considers that this is a challenge to its position on high tech.
Right. And this has been a major factor in the trade negotiations between China and the United States too, correct?
Absolutely. Central question. The US accuses China, obviously, of stealing technologies, but also of unfairly using state support and state investment to develop R&D and to aid particular companies. This is, I find, ironic, because if we believe what the neoliberals say, then actually it should be to the detriment of China that it interferes with the market in this way by giving government subsidies. But the US tacitly accepts the fact that this is more efficient because it says it's unfair that these companies get these government subsidies.
That's a very important point, right? Because, I mean, since the 1970s, 1980s, United States government, the British government, the French government, the IMF, the World Bank, you know, all the great Western economic powers have been going around the world and telling people, including their own populations, that the only way for an economy to grow, the only way for people to experience economic development, you know, especially in countries that were formerly colonized by, you know, some of those very same economic powerhouses in the West, is to adopt, you know, as you say, neoliberal economic policies, to deregulate, to open up to international investment and trade without very much restrictions or maybe no restrictions at all.
Rely on what they call the hidden hand of the market.
Exactly, exactly. How does China do it differently?
Well, China relies on both the hidden and the rather open hand of the market. It's not that it's against markets. It would be mad to be against markets. If even the most dyed-in-the-wool communists can't be against markets, because actually it's quite an efficient way of distributing things. But as long as they're regulated, and as long as there's not complete dog-eat-dog madness, and that's what China insists upon. It insists upon state-led investment to develop new technologies, control over its banks, etc., and its currency, in order to be able to most efficiently involve itself in the market. And this, according to the neoliberals, shouldn't work at all.
We're talking with Jude Woodward. She's the author of the book, The U.S. versus China, Asia's New Cold War. We're talking about the situation with Huawei suing the U.S. government and also Huawei CFO. Let's turn to Mengwan Zhu now. She is in Canada. She's been detained in Canada for quite a long time now, for a few months. And it's become, you know, a major bone of contention between, you know, not just the Chinese and the Canadian government, but really and primarily the Chinese and U.S. government, because Canada is holding the Huawei CFO based on an extradition request from the United States. So just first of all, fill us in on the background. What is Mengwan Zhu accused of?
Well, she's accused of having misled the US over the involvement of Huawei in activities which amounted to sanctions busting in Iran. Again, she's not had the evidence. She knows what the accusation is, but there's been little drip feed of what they rely on, some of which is incredibly old. And they must have known it for years, which, you know, rather casts doubt over why at this point they move against her, even if the evidence is true, which we don't know. But I think she's taken this civil action in Canada, claiming unfair arrest, violation of her civil rights, etc., etc. Again, I think this is less about winning such a case than trying, because on an extradition procedure, there's very little that can be done in terms of calling on evidence. Whereas if there is a case on these grounds, she could, she hopes that, I think, and her lawyers hope that they could get the more of the evidence for the US's case out into the open, or find out what it is themselves and be in a best position to judge what is really going on.
Right. So it's totally extraterritorial, right? I mean, the United States is basically orchestrating the arrest of a major business leader for violating, you know, not Chinese in the law, right? Not even Canadian law, the law of the country that she was arrested in, but an edict from the United States that you must not trade with Iran.
Right.
So, you know, I think it makes a lot of sense what you're saying, that the arrest was political, right? I mean, it took place at a key time in U.S.-China trade negotiations and the trade war. It seemed to me to be time to perhaps intentionally undermine talks between U.S. President Donald Trump and Xi Jinping that were taking place at the G20 summit in Argentina. With all that in mind, we've got about a minute left. I mean, do you see this being resolved in the courts, or do you think that there'll be a fundamentally like political resolution to the extradition case?
Oh, it's very hard to say. I think it's clear that the Chinese hope there can be a political agreement about this, and it can maybe just get signed off in the context of the trade talks. Donald Trump indicated that that might be a possibility, and then came out with a statement which said he wouldn't interfere. So you're getting mixed messages, as you have had all along on these trade talks from Donald Trump. It's not at all clear which direction things are going. The administration is clearly split on what to do about it, and I think Trump's statements partially reflect that split. So I think it's very hard to say, but what I think we can say is this is going to go on for a long time, because there are lots of appeal procedures in the Canadian legal system. So she is going to be in Canada, if this isn't settled by some other route, she's going to be in Canada for years, not for a few months.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. We've been joined from London by Jude Woodward. She's the author of the book, The U.S. versus China, Asia's New Cold War. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Venezuelan oppositionist Juan Guaido returned to the country yesterday after meeting with the right-wing leaders of Colombia and Brazil in defiance of a Supreme Court order prohibiting him from leaving the country. He breezed through Customs and Immigration without incident and then brazenly called for the overthrow of President Nicolas Maduro at a rally in Caracas. Supporters of both Maduro and Guaido will hold large-scale demonstrations on Saturday. We're joined from Venezuela by Anya Parampil. She's a Washington-based journalist for the Gray Zone Project. Welcome back, Anya.
Hey, guys. I'm actually back in D.C., but I was in Caracas up until Sunday.
So, Anya, we've talked about this question before. I'm going to ask you again. This U.S.-backed coup or coup attempt, it's just not working out the way Washington thought it was going to work out. What were you seeing on the ground while you were there in terms of Maduro's support versus Guaido's support, and how Maduro has been able to maintain his position all this time?
Well, I just read this stunningly false opinion piece in the New York Times by an academic named Javier Corrales, who claims at the beginning of his piece that nobody knows for sure who the real president of Venezuela is at the moment, Nicolas Maduro or Juan Guaido. And I can tell you, that is just so unbelievable to me that someone could make that claim, because I was on the ground in Caracas for 3 weeks. And I think I said this last week on your show, but I'll say it again. Even among the opposition, there's no belief currently that Juan Guaido is president. They believe the United States is trying to help him become president, and they're confident that can happen on the opposition side. But there's not, you know, any question of who's currently governing Venezuela at the moment. Juan Guaido has no, you know, address where he could even claim to be governing from. It's all quite a bit absurd. And the government has stayed strong, and there have been pro-government rallies all across the country in recent weeks. Millions of people have taken to the streets to show that they still stand with the democratically elected government of Maduro. And so, you know, I get this feeling that Guaido and Marco Rubio and John Bolton, President Trump, they're all running a what feels like a social media coup, a reality show coup, a Twitter campaign, really, is what it seems like, because there's no effect on the ground. There is just none.
If you listen to the mainstream media here, of course, Juan Guaido is the president of Venezuela. Nicolas Maduro is either a communist or a socialist or a fascist or something like that, whatever fits into your ideological outlook. And it's just a matter of time until the forces of democracy and good and human rights are triumphant. And it's because, of course, the Venezuelan economy is collapsing. Venezuelan society is collapsing. People are in the streets. But as it turned out, none of that was true, was it?
No, it wasn't. And I think I saw Senator Rubio even complaining yesterday that CNN is now referring to Juan Guaido as opposition leader and the self-proclaimed president of Venezuela.
They must so be he's listening been demoted. To our show.
He's been demoted by CNN, and you know things aren't working well for your U.S.-backed coup if even CNN isn't recognizing Juan Guaido as president. It's been very absurd, yes, to watch the way the media continues to make the point that because of the suffering of the Venezuelan people, they're going to just open their arms and accept Guaido. Everybody I spoke to there has a very complex understanding as to why they're suffering economically. You know, there's not a humanitarian crisis in the country the way that we're hearing in the mainstream media. There's an economic crisis. The buying power of Venezuelans has been hurt. There's, you know, no price controls. It's hard for them to buy some basic goods, though they are, you know, still receiving support from the government, deliveries of food staples every month. It hasn't worked because they understand that U.S. sanctions and a U.S.-led economic war is the root of their problem. So they're not going to accept the U.S. solution to that. And it might be really hard for people in Washington and for U.S.-based journalists to accept that. But you know, all you have to do is go to Caracas and show up and talk to regular people on the street, and it becomes very clear.
Anya, you know, one of the sort of mantras of the Trump administration and the media, including the anti-Trump corporate-owned media like CNN or MSNBC, is that Venezuela is a failed state, it's a failed economy, and it clearly has major problems like hyperinflation, mismanagement, corruption, etc., all of which the people who are supporters of the Bolivarian process, the supporters of Nicolas Maduro, widely admit. I mean, that's an economic problem. But one of the things that they point to is they show that people are leaving Venezuela, and they say, see, people are leaving Venezuela because they're desperate, and that shows that socialism has failed in Venezuela. But the same people, not the same people, but people who are also desperate are leaving Honduras, they're leaving El Salvador, they're leaving other non-socialist capitalist countries in Latin America, and you never hear the mantra, they're leaving because these poor souls are escaping,
yeah,
the awful social system called capitalism. And so you have these like actual realities, but the propaganda war is another big piece of what we're experiencing. Go ahead.
Well, I think that has I think that is what's driving the Trump administration's policy towards Venezuela right now. You know, we don't want to rule anything out because with the people that are around President Trump right now, like John Bolton, Elliot Abrams, and President Trump himself, anything is possible. We can't pretend as though military intervention or further violent action against Venezuela can be ruled out. At the same time, the honest sense that I get is that this is a media war, not just in the sense that, you know, what happened on the 23rd of February on the border with Colombia was an event essentially staged to get media attention and to try and create the justification for further intervention. It didn't happen. But even if you paid attention to Trump's speech in Florida, where he was, you know, supposed to be talking about the situation in Venezuela, it was mostly a speech just ranting against socialism and socialist policies. And that may have more to do with domestic politics than Venezuela itself. And I get the feeling that the Trump administration would like a prolonged battle against the Venezuelan state, where they can point to it because of, you know, say the U.S.-led economic war and sanctions that have weakened the country, and say, look how socialism's failed. You don't want that here. And that's what makes me think, you know, further military action may not happen in the immediate future, because the longer Venezuela stays around, the longer the Trump administration and elites in the United States can point to it as a failure of socialism, when, you know, people who follow the situation or talk to people there will say the fact that Venezuela has actually withstood U.S. sabotage for this long is actually a testament to its strength.
That is very insightful. We're speaking from Washington with Anya Parampil. She just returned from 3 weeks in Caracas, Venezuela. She's telling us about the situation on the ground there. Anya, along the same line, because you've actually made me think of something that I hadn't considered, and that being that this is a domestic political issue for Trump. What about others like Marco Rubio, people in Congress? Are they going to want to milk this like Rubio and Trump seem to be wanting to milk it for their own domestic political points?
Well, Rubio obviously, you know, is appealing to right-wing Cubans and Venezuelans.
And there are a lot of them in Florida, right?
Yeah. But there's also a generation of younger Cubans who are more progressive and were supporting Obama's efforts to open up to Cuba and Latin America. Now, Rubio is attempting to, you know, rally the base back behind his you know, right-wing aggressive stance on Venezuela. And Trump, you know, he's willing to just, even though he was so humiliated by Trump during the Republican debate process, he's now willing to just go be Trump's errand boy on the Venezuelan border. But he, again, seems to be totally failing. I haven't really been paying such close attention to what's going on in Congress specifically, because I've been in Venezuela. But from what I can see, there is a strong opposition to military intervention against Venezuela, at least within the Democratic Party and within the more progressive side. So it doesn't seem like any war with Venezuela will gain traction there.
I'm glad you mentioned that. While you were gone, Anya, a lot of opposition has been building in the United States. On Saturday, March 16th, which is a week from this Saturday, people are coming from all over the country to come to Washington, D.C. for a national march under the slogans, no to a coup, no to sanctions, no to a new war. Very, very important for the American people to understand that if you don't want Donald Trump and John Bolton or Mike Pompeo pretending that they are the masters of the universe or certainly capable of dictating the future of people of Latin America or possibly eventually taking the country to war, we have to stand up and speak out. And I know a lot of people will be joining us Saturday, March 16th at 12 noon in front of the White House. Anyway, John, I think we're completely out of time.
We are out of time. We were joined from Washington by Anya Parampil. She is a Washington-based journalist for the Gray Zone Project. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be back after a short break.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. The Trump administration has canceled agreements that give Turkey and India preferential treatment in trade. The U.S. Trade Representative's office said that India has not allowed more U.S. goods into the country in contravention of the current agreement, and Turkey no longer qualifies for trade concessions. While the U.S.-China trade war might be cooling down, we'll see about that, the Trump administration is now moving to ignite conflicts with other major economies. We're joined from London by Steve Keen. Steve is the author of Debunking Economics, and he is the world's first crowdfunded economist. You can check out his work at patreon.com/ProfSteveKeen, and Keen is K-E-E-N. And we're joined in studio by Walter Smolarek, Sputnik News analyst. Steve, Walter, welcome back.
Glad to be here.
Good to be here.
The Trump administration is picking a lot of fights, Steve Keen, including with countries that are traditional allies of the United States or countries that the United States has been wooing, or in the case of Turkey, the eastern flank of a U.S.-led military alliance. Anyway, do you think it's a significant set of events?
Not particularly. It's just a continuation of two things. One is Americans trying to do the impossible, and that's trying to get to the stage where they have a balanced trade deficit, neither a trade deficit nor a surplus. When they have, there's the reserve currency, everybody has to buy American dollars to trade. And that means the American dollar is necessarily overvalued. It necessarily is going to run a trade deficit with the rest of the world. So they're trying to square the circle fundamentally. And this is another instance of Trump not realizing he's trying to make a square into a circle.
The deficit is not going down. I mean, in spite of all of the efforts of the Trump administration and the focus on the trade deficit as like the thing, it hasn't gone down. In fact, it's gone up.
Yeah, it's going to have to do that continually because like starting about 35 years ago, America started taking advantage of free trade zones in the rest of the world, particularly, of course, China, when China joined the whole game in 81, 82, to explicitly rip off American consumers without paying American workers for the privilege. And they moved all the production from the Midwest of America to third world countries, in particular China. And that's where the trade deficit came from. And one reason they could do it, apart from the fact that Chinese wages are much lower than American wages, is that the American dollar is necessarily overvalued because it's the reserve currency, which itself was an American decision back at the time of Bretton Woods overruling Keynes, who wanted to have an international currency he called the Bancor used. Harry Dexter White, for the American delegation, said no, it had to be the American dollar. That set up the entire situation. The only way out of this is to end the Americans' position as the reserve currency. But the last things Americans are going to do is do that because they have this American exceptionalism attitude that they should be the reserve currency. So they want to make something impossible happen. And unfortunately, you can't make the impossible happen.
Are you surprised by how aggressive the Trump administration is pursuing these protectionist measures? I mean, it's one thing for the Trump administration to target China, right, because China politically is sort of a common punching bag in U.S. politics, and it's also a central strategic target of the Pentagon, right, according to its latest national security strategy. But now we have these measures being taken against India, which is quite geopolitically important for the United States. And Turkey, which, you know, of course, the relationship has been strained, but it is a NATO member. I mean, the U.S. traditionally does a lot of business with Turkey. It seems like the Trump administration is kind of going after anybody and everybody.
Well, that's not uncommon. I mean, you can't leave Trump's personality out of this. And the guy's a racist, quite fundamentally. So he doesn't see any problem in screwing the Indians or trying to do so. And I think it's just idiotic to try to analyze this without including his personality in the entire game. We know he's racist. He's been called racist by his previous advisors. He would have no problem in doing this because he wouldn't have any regard of equality between himself and Indians. And this is just, again, typical of his personal behavior.
Steve Keen, for people who are not engaged in finance or trade, who are not trained economists, they're probably confused by some of the language here and also how things just work. For international trade, and that's what we're talking about with a trade deficit, that means the United States is importing more goods from other countries than it's exporting to those countries or to the rest of the world. And just in terms of how this works, in international trade, if somebody wants to buy products that are made in the United States, they do so by using dollars. And so they take their currency, let's say it's the yuan in China, the dong in Vietnam, they have to use their currency to buy dollars, to trade for dollars, and then use those dollars to buy American products. So if their currencies are weaker currencies than the dollar, it means it requires more money from them to buy dollars, to buy American products. And that's what makes American exports more expensive. Is that basically it?
That's a very good summary. And that's the fundamental dilemma, because normally when you were to buy another currency's currency, a country's goods, then you have to convert into that particular currency. And that means, you know, a conversion which drives down the value of the other currency fundamentally. But here you're driving up the value of the currency to buy their goods. And that gives you an imbalance. I haven't done any numerical estimations, but my rule of thumb is the American dollar is worth at least 30% more than it should be. And I've seen economists who've estimated the American dollar is at least twice the value it should be. Given that situation, of course, you're going to run a trade deficit.
So if the dollar devalued, say, 30%, that means Americans who hold dollars can buy less with those dollars because they just purchase less. But it means American exporters will be able to sell more American products overseas because it's less expensive for those purchasing American exporters. Let me just ask you then, is there a division, a stress, a point of stress, or a point of, I don't know, even confrontation within the different sectors of the U.S. economy over this issue of the strong dollar?
Yeah, this is absolutely fundamental because, for a start, the American working class is being done over by this because they're the ones whose jobs have been lost by transferring those jobs to low-wage countries in the rest of the world, which are low-wage countries partly because the American dollar is overvalued. And then secondly, it's to the advantage of financial capital at the expense of industrial capital, because if you are an American financial corporation, your money is used to buy goods in the rest of the world, which can't be done by any other country because the other countries don't have the global reserve currency. So it's in the favor of the financial sector against the industrial sector, and it's in favor of financial capitalists in particular against the working class.
We've been talking about some of the fundamental sort of systemic issues with the U.S. dollar, its role in the global economy going back to the Bretton Woods Conference as World War II was drawing to a close. But there's also sort of more immediate actions that have been taken by the U.S. Federal Reserve, effectively the central bank of the United States, that also will, you know, result or, you know, has the intention of resulting in a stronger dollar. And that's the increase of interest rates. Explain how interest rates are related to the value of a currency. And do you think that this is sort of why Donald Trump has been so publicly hostile or critical of the Federal Reserve, because it sort of undercuts his desire to reduce the trade deficit?
Oh, well, partly that's a different issue to some extent, because the value of the currency is really determined by the central bank. There's actually a very good Reserve Bank of Australia video explaining, once they set a target rate for a currency, for an interest rate, how do they maintain that target rate? And fundamentally, central banks have an unlimited budget to be able to do that. When we have floating exchange rates, there's no capacity really to stop a central bank setting a range for the base rate of interest. The interest applies to short-term government bonds and short-term commercial bonds. They can't be stopped in setting a rate that they want to stop. So this is actually a separate issue. If you have a devaluing currency, then one way to try to stop that devaluation is to put up your reserve interest rates. And you see Turkey has done that. I think the rate in Turkey now exceeds 20% to try to stop their currency falling. But fundamentally, this is a separate issue.
Right. I mean, there's the question of inflation, right? Because in Turkey, there's very high inflation. You know, as you were saying, the value of the currency falling, that's, you know, the same thing, you know, in terms of how consumers feel it as prices going up. In the United States, it's been pretty surprising. There really hasn't been hardly any inflation to speak of. Well, how do you define that phenomenon? I know that's kind of a big question in economics today, and there's a lot of divided opinion on it.
One of the funny things I've done in recent times, I had to work out a pricing equation for my dynamic models of Minsky's financial instability hypothesis, and I refused to use the standard model non-orthodox economists use, which is called Kolesi's markup pricing equation, that said that prices are fundamentally a markup on wage costs. But I had to use supply and demand, the conventional neoclassical idea, but in a monetary framework. And when I worked out the equations, in terms of saying there's a flow of demand pushing prices up and a flow of supply pushing prices down, what I got out of it was the idea that prices basically are a markup on wage costs, where the markup reflects the bargaining power of capitalists versus workers. So fundamentally, if you have low bargaining power for workers, which is clearly the case in America right now, and a high markup for capitalists, you can have a low rate of inflation. Now, when you get to the stage when unemployment gets to incredibly low levels, in that situation in America, there are no trade unions to bargain for wage rises anymore. But firms will start bidding up wages to try to get hold of workers because they're having a shortage, and you'll have inflation coming through that way. So it's a sign of how depowered workers are by having unions being slaughtered in the last 30 or 40 years in America, and how the labour market still isn't tight enough to have inflation coming out of it. But in a short while, I think if the unemployment rates keeps on falling in America, then you will see an inflationary surge, because finally corporations will find themselves forced to put up wages to try to get workers out of the diminishing level of the unemployed pool in America. So it really comes down fundamentally to a class struggle, and for a long time the capitalists have been winning. Only when workers have a huge amount of bargaining power with a very high level of employment do you see inflation taking place. And that'll happen later in the cycle now than it ever would have before.
Yeah, an important point about unions. We are out of time, though. We've been joined from London by Steve Keen. He's the author of Debunking Economics, and he's the world's first crowdfunded economist. You can check out his work and support his work at patreon.com/profstevekeen. That's K-E-E-N. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. Following statements from top European leaders, including the Irish Prime Minister and the President of the European Council, expectations are mounting that the long-anticipated departure of the UK from the European Union will be delayed. British Prime Minister Theresa May is still holding out for a March 29th Brexit, however, and is desperately maneuvering to improve her government's position. We're joined from London by Neil Clark. Neil is a journalist and broadcaster whose work has appeared in The Guardian, The Week, and Morning Star. Neil, welcome back to Loud and Clear.
Hi, Brian. How are you?
I'm well. We're also joined in studio by Walter Smolarek. Walter is a Sputnik News analyst. Walter, welcome.
Happy to be here.
Neil, bring us up to date. What's going on?
Well, it's looking more and more likely that we may get a three-month delay to the date when we're supposed to be leaving, Britain's supposed to be leaving the EU. There was a nice cartoon in the Sunday Express, one of the leading Sunday newspapers here at the weekend, showing Theresa May exclaiming, yes, we're still going to leave on the 29th of March, but I'm not going to say which 29th of March, whether it's this year or next year. That's the kind of state we're in at the moment. And of course, what happens next is we got the vote in Parliament. It's due for next Tuesday. I think that's the 12th of March, where we'll have another vote on a revamped on Theresa May's, you know, the revamped withdrawal agreement. And the big question is whether that will get past the House of Commons or not. And you could argue either way. It's going to be very close. Certainly, there are already. We've seen a number of Tory, what you would call, I don't like this phraseology, hard and soft Brexiteers, but you've seen some of the ERG group, who are the more, if you like, staunch Brexiteers in the Tory party, hinting that they may change their line on Theresa May's deal. Beforehand, they voted against it because they thought it was Brexit in name only. It kept us too tied up to the EU. But it's like a poker game, really. Do these Brexiteers want to sign up to Theresa May's deal, even though it isn't ideal for them? Or do they want to take the risk of having this delayed further and perhaps not happening at all, when you bear in mind now that the Labour Party line has shifted? Well, the Labour Party line is now basically that they support a second referendum on this, on Britain leaving the EU and the other options. So it's all pretty still uncertain what's going to happen. And I think, after next Tuesday's vote, things will be a lot clearer.
Yeah. So just to recap then for our audience, and again, Americans have a hard time understanding how their government works, almost no understanding of how the British system works. But what's happening, it seems, in terms of what you're saying, Neil, is that Jeremy Corbyn and the Labour Party are now saying, look, let's have a second referendum. If there was a second referendum, it's very possible that the decision would come out completely different. Instead of leaving the EU, there might be a vote to remain. That puts pressure on the so-called zealous or hard Brexit forces within the Tory party to actually make a compromise and go along with Theresa May, in which case they could possibly have a vote that would squeak through. Is that kind of where we are?
Yeah, absolutely. I think we don't have a parliamentary majority for having, to have a second referendum, Brian, we'd have to have that pass through parliament. And there isn't the votes there, because already we've had a number of Labour MPs, people like Caroline Flint, who's an MP in Yorkshire for a strong Leave seat. She's come out and said that she can't support a second referendum. A lot of MPs, Labour MPs, particularly, Brian, in those strong pro-Brexit areas in the north and in the Midlands, have come out against Labour support for a second referendum, and they're not going to vote for one. And you're not going to get many Tories voting for a second referendum anyway. So with the parliamentary math as it is, it's pretty academic at this stage. We're not likely to get one. Having said that, it could still happen further down the line, really. And it all depends really what happens next week's vote. Will enough Labour MPs, there will be some perhaps Labour MPs who would decide to defy the party whips and vote for Theresa May's deal. Then you've got the big question is how many of the so-called hard Brexiteers would actually vote for Theresa May's deal on the basis that, look, it does take us out of the EU. It would take us out of the EU, even though it's far from ideal, because it still gives the EU will still have a lot of input in, particularly in the ongoing negotiations afterwards. So it's a question really of finding something that can get through Parliament, which can get a majority in Parliament. There is no majority in the British Parliament for what you would call a hard Brexit. Equally, there's no majority for a second referendum. So what there is a majority for, you could argue, would be the softest of soft Brexits. But would that actually be enough, really, to please the, you said, the more zealous supporters of Brexit in the Tory party in relation to Theresa May, leadership challenge, all that kind of thing comes into play then. So for those reasons, basically, the odds of having an extension, and Theresa May is already mooted at this, of say 3 months, becomes more and more likely, if she doesn't get her deal through Parliament next Tuesday.
Why is this going down to the wire? We're using terms in which, you know, you said are imprecise, of course, but, you know, hard Brexit, soft Brexit. What does that mean in terms of specific policy proposals and actions?
I think it's important to understand we've got a Prime Minister, Theresa May, who is a Remainer, basically. She supported remaining in the EU. She took over from David Cameron, and it was her job, her task was to implement the democratic vote in the referendum of 2016. And so she has never been a Brexiteer herself. She feels obliged to carry it out. And of course, the big debate that we're going on is what actually did that vote mean, Brian, on the 23rd of June 2016? Clearly, we had a majority by 4% voted to leave. The question on the ballot paper was, do you support Britain to leaving the EU? That was it. But we didn't have any subsidiary questions about what kind of relationship do you want with the EU if we do leave? And that's where the problems lie, because of course you could support leaving the EU and come up with a position which was a Labour position that it makes common sense for us to stay in a customs union with our closest European neighbours, because we do our most trade with them geographically, we're very close to them, so it makes sense to have a tariff-free customs union with them and not pay duties on imports and exports. Okay, then you get the question of the single market. Going further, do you want to get the closest possible association with the single market, which is the Labour position, or do you want to say, no, the single market means accepting too many EU rules and regulations? That's the reason we want to get out. So you can see that within the very binary yes, no, leave, remain, there are all kinds of shades of opinion ranging from, if you like, the hardest of hardcore Brexiteers would say, leave the EU, we don't want a customs union, we don't want a single market, we will do trade deals on our own with European countries. It's in their interest to do it. Let's leave. If we have to leave without a deal, then good. Leave without a deal. And equally, you've got the very soft Brexiteers who would, on the balance of probabilities, think, yes, it's a good idea if we leave because we're paying so much. We're net contributors to the EU budget, so we'll make financial savings. However, it's common sense for us to have the closest possible trading agreements with Europe, with the European Union, without actually being in the EU.
Another issue that's arisen in recent days is the so-called Brexit bribes that Theresa May is proposing or has in mind for certain constituencies. Tell us what that means and what it indicates about the overall political position that she finds herself in.
It's very interesting because the government have announced that so-called struggling communities, and there are, of course, communities in Britain that have been hit terribly hard by the austerity policies of the Conservative-led government since 2010. Places in the northeast of England, particularly the post-industrial areas, they were the areas that voted strongest for Brexit. And what Theresa May's government said, that they've said that an initial £1 billion is going to be pumped into these communities, these so-called left-behind communities, as a sort of Brexit dividend, if you like, that the money will go into these. Now, the Conservatives are promoting this as a very good measure because Theresa May actually said that the wealth has not been spread evenly around Britain. That's an understatement. That's the understatement of the century. And she said that, acknowledged that the reason these parts of the country voted so strongly for Brexit was because the people there wanted a change. So this is, if you like, her trying to get support in those areas. The Labour Party has come out and said this is a bribe. You know, you're trying to bribe Labour voters in these areas to look favourably on the Conservatives. You could make the point, of course, that this is only money that has really been taken away from these communities or hasn't been spent there due to austerity. However, I must acknowledge it's very clever politics from Theresa May, because the Labour Party, we know that for them electorally, the road to get to power is through leave voting seats. For example, I think it was 45 out of the 60 seats that are their target seats all voted for Brexit, and the leading 13 seats that are held by the Tories that they've got to win in the next election were all strong leave supporting seats. So, in other words, Labour Party has taken a very big risk electorally with its policy of backing a second referendum, which is seen perhaps as being trying to block Brexit. And so Theresa May, I think, is exploiting this to the full by saying to those areas of the country that traditionally vote Labour, look, Labour wants to have a second referendum. We're trying to deliver Brexit. And moreover, if we get the Brexit, we're going to pump money into your areas. And you can understand why Labour is pretty upset by this.
That was the voice of Neil Clark. Neil joined us from London. He's a journalist and broadcaster. His work has appeared in The Guardian, The Week, and Morning Star. We were also joined in studio by Walter Smolarek. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and you want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. You can also follow us on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can also hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spreaker, and Spotify. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We are out of here.
Loud and clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.